We have Carl Gunter and David Coates. And the reason that Carl and David were chosen for this panel, among others, is that they have each been the PI of a large center grant focused on healthcare IT, and in particular, looking at security issues for these. So Carl Gunter was the PI for the SHARPS grant, which really kind of, as Eugene said in the opening comments, created this research community and this particular workshop. It was $15.5 million over four years, right? And David Coates is the current PI of the NSF Frontiers Thaw Project, Trustworthy Health and Wellness, and that is a $10 million 5-year grant. And so we've got $25.5 million worth of answering for what have you done. And what I'd like to do with this panel is start out with I'm going to ask the panelists a couple of questions, let them answer and discuss among themselves, and then give them the opportunity if they want to ask each other questions, and then we'll open it up to all of you. So my first question is, I heard in this talk a lot of problems with software, a lot of problems with legacy systems. There was a mention that Epic systems touch half the patients in the U.S. right now. They're on an Epic system. And so the question I have is, as researchers, what can we do to transfer our technology into practice? How can we actually have an impact on real-world systems if there's so much legacy out there and if things are so bad? What can we do to get our research to actually change the way healthcare IT is practiced? And anyone on the panel can take that first, and then maybe we'll have some other comments. Hopefully there's some idea of what we can do.
So the first thing, obviously, is we must demand data standards, data format standards, so that we can achieve the interoperability that would allow people to be free of some of that hegemony. And then we need to have standards on the quality of the software. It's not tested for quality, I'm serious. It's not tested for safety. It's not tested for cybersecurity. It's only tested, do they have certain basic functions? And those functions are not tested in a real context or time limited. In other words, you can be certified on a function of your EHR, even though it takes a team of doctors 4 hours to do it, when the actual real doctor would have about 2 seconds. But that will pass, so they could change the regulations.
Let me just challenge that for 1 second. So I'm a professor at Johns Hopkins, and I want to change healthcare IT, even if I can do it just a little bit. You've got Epic out there, just sold a $1 billion system to Hopkins. They don't care about my standard, and they're not going to care if I convene a whole bunch of people in this room and we draft a standard. Is there any way that researchers, people who are in academia, can influence any standards?
So one thing I thought would be a response I had to this was that all of the sectors, when you try to do the security changes and try to do changes in usability, have a certain inertia and resistance. And so although I guess I'm on the panel because of the healthcare project, I did also work on power grid security, some work we started in 2005. And it was surprising at the time how resistant they were to the idea that there would be anything done differently from the way they were already doing it. And I could give you examples of, you know, their security standards at the time, like, you know, we have a dial-in modem for resetting substation functions, and we don't give out the phone number to people who are not authorized. So that would be an example of a security. But over the years, you know, over time, there was an introduction of a certain amount of fluidity, and people did change, and you got an impact on the sectors. At the moment, it feels pretty hopeless to much impact Epic. However, there are areas of the field where there's much more fluidity, in the mobile area, where there's a rapid growth. And another area where there might be some opportunity is where we do health records on clouds, because that's not a settled sector yet with a dominant market vendor. And so I wouldn't become pessimistic on these things too rapidly, that you know, there are areas of change that are occurring now, and even when things don't look like they're changing, you know, they eventually do.
So what you're saying, though, is that we need to move quickly before a large player sets a standard that becomes de facto, and then there's less opportunity for us.
Yeah, one might do that. You say, let's focus on the areas where there's no settled dominant vendor. You know, these big vendors have their own challenges with respect to changes. For example, Epic will be faced with threats to cloud-based systems, which you know, is a different model from the one they use. And we do have play, you know, in security there. They're also challenged by the mobile markets, which they haven't integrated with these systems. And so those are two areas where a lot's changing, and we can have a difference made by what we do. Not that we couldn't have an effect also on the EHRs, but these are other areas.
I guess I would have two points. One is that there are some venues in which academics can be a part of the conversation. For example, the HIT Standards Committee, which is one of the committees, federal advisory committees to ONC, that actually discusses and recommends specific standards to ONC, and then it eventually goes through their regulatory process. That's a, you know, a small and indirect way, but it, you know, that's a seat at the table if you can get on that committee. The other is, it's my impression that demonstrating that something actually works, you know, in terms of medical outcomes, goes a long way. And so if you can partner with a healthcare provider, even a small, relatively small clinic or maybe an academic medical center that's used to research, not easy to do. We've had challenges ourselves at Dartmouth. If you can partner with them and try a new way of doing something, a new piece of technology, a new interface, a new standard, a new protocol, and demonstrate that it actually improves safety or productivity or patient outcomes or something like that, and publish it in the medical literature, that's, I think, one step towards actually having an impact. If you just stand up and give papers at, frankly, computer science conferences, you're not going to have much impact.
Okay.
I still think there's room for exposés. Congress has now two committees that are looking at EPIC and their hegemonic position. And I've just had a paper accepted in a major journal entitled, "What Are the Dangers of an EPIC Monoculture?" So there are some cracks in that wall.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My next question is... Yeah.
Let me
do you want to follow up?
Yeah, let me follow up. There are, not to be too hopeless about EPIC, there are areas of possible extension with respect to EPIC where one can do research, especially if you do what Dave said, which is if you have a partner. So in particular, one area for security researchers is that EPIC has a flood of audit data that it can produce. And so some of these questions that Ross was discussing, you really could actually go in and get answers to those things from those logs. And so that, you know, with proper partnerships, there would be opportunities to extend EPIC per se with new security precautions. And it sounds like there's a synergy between security precautions and safety reviews that's suggested by the talk. And so that might be a ripe area for working with existing systems.
Okay, thank you. So my next question is, every time I hear anyone talk about HIPAA or high tech, I hear a lot of criticisms and I hear about all the problems that it creates. And my question for the panel is, what regulation do we wish we had? What would be the ideal regulation that would come down from Washington that would actually make healthcare IT better?
Well, you're on the committee.
To say anything.
If you're allowed to say.
When I talk about HIPAA, I show a Rorschach ink blot, because HIPAA is whatever, you know, the staff feels like using to deny you access for something. I mean, the idea behind HIPAA was portability, and now it's, of course, used for the exact opposite. And in terms of data security, by the way, a vendor can go out of business and deny you access to your own data, but a doctor who wants to dispose of data has only the decision that it can be shredded or something like that. There's a whole issue of data security when vendors go out of business or do whatever they do that has not been touched, and the profound security implications.
So not responding directly to that question with a particular piece of legislation.
Okay, that's what I'm used to.
Oh, yeah, right. It's an indirect professor type kind of thing. Is that one thing I often feel is worth emphasizing, though, is that in many of these cases, it feels to me like it's wrong-headed to think that the way you're going to address the problem is that the market is going to take care of it. Right, so this, you know, there was a report that came out, which is the business case for security and privacy in hospitals. Now, I think it's nice to write the report, and, you know, I think that this is good, that whatever they can assemble, you know, is great. But in many cases, especially in the healthcare sector, security is what economists call an externality. It's like, you know, the dumping of pollution into the local stream. If you don't have to pay attention to patient security and privacy, then it will make your hospital run more efficiently, and the business cost to you of breaches are probably going to be relatively small compared to the cost to the patient of those breaches. And so that I would say that concerning regulations, that we should be unabashed about its being the case that we're substituting for a market gap, and that, you know, having regulations that call for security and privacy are necessary and should be enforced and should be elaborated. And so these things of keeping audit logs, requiring people to review the audit logs and so on, I think are good hygiene and, you know, fair game.
I would agree with that. I guess I would also want to ensure that there are strong incentives to work together, to cooperate, to interchange data. One way to be secure is to just put a wall around yourself and don't allow any data in or out. But one of the potential benefits of healthcare information technology is the possibility of sharing your medical records with other providers that you visit, and so that the collective set of providers you use can provide you better healthcare, and so that you can do research on large populations of patients and so forth. And so I guess in terms of regulation, I would be interested in mechanisms that strongly encourage interchange of data, of health data, and such things exist. And interoperability is one of the major limiting factors there. And in fact, ONC just recently came out with their 10-year vision to achieve an interoperable health IT infrastructure, which I was just reading yesterday. It came out a few months ago. Frankly, it doesn't say a lot. It's one of these fluffy feel-good, like, oh, yes, we all need to be interoperable. But it has a 3-year, a 6-year, and a 10-year kind of vision of where they want to be in terms of being able to interchange data. And I think that's really important to achieve the benefits of this technology.
I think we'll go to the audience in a minute, but just want to give the panelists a chance to ask other panelists questions or to say something they want to say, and then we can open it up.
Yeah, I had another panelist remark, which is concerning regulations, and I want to continue the theme of, like, don't be too upset that they haven't done everything you hoped they would do. I had the experience of going into my patient portal, which was Epic, actually, and found that among the things that were available in my Epic portal was a download of my consolidated CDA standardized format. I went and looked at it, and I didn't have an editor, so I had to read XML with, you know, to look at it. But this is a tremendous step forward. I mean, this is huge. I mean, I can download my medical record in a digitally standardized format now. I didn't think we would get that far, you know, by this point in time. And so the regulations have had some salutary benefits. And so I think for our community, we have to show people that there's a reason for doing this. In other words, you're going to have to be able to exchange and process these things and do interesting things with them. And that'll be a huge challenge. But, you know, that I think is we got something available to us that we didn't have before.
Yeah, I mean, down the hall we've got HotSec, where they're talking about all the malware that's on everyone's computer, and having a portal where you can log in and access your medical records, and you probably will do that when that computer's under the control of who knows whom.
And download it to local.
Right, is a little scary to me.
But.
Yeah, so Epic has been criticized for adding some proprietary suffixes to the CCDA, which is the comprehensive data that Carl was discussing, that's supposed to be true interoperability, and there's some papers coming out showing that they're not as interoperable as we'd like. But it's an attempt to pick about 40 variables that most people would want, and it's a start. But my question is, why do we have a 10-year vision when we've always wanted interoperability, when we know that if we had data standards and data format standards, we could have it by, you know, not Thursday, but next year at this Thursday?
I think interoperable standards are the first part of the first step. And yeah, I share your disappointment that it might take 10 years to get to that level.
Just when this nation started, there was both left and right-hand side driving. And somebody said, well, let's just pick a thing. There were, in this nation, 115 time zones. You could leave Cleveland and arrive in Cincinnati before you left. And the railroad companies said to the federal government, you got to give us time zones. This is crazy. Our cost just in printing schedules is going nuts. But it was the railroad companies in 1860s, early 60s, who each had their own gauges. And each railroad company went to Lincoln, then president, and said, it's got to be our gauge or everything will fail. And Lincoln said, screw it. By next year, it's all going to be X gauge. And they said, no, if you do that, capitalism will never exist in America. And it turned out that imposing standards is often very helpful for capitalism. So I think we're so intimidated by the power of these companies, but to make their own lives better and patients' lives better, sometimes we're going to have to stick to our proverbials.
Okay, well, I think this is a good time to open it up. I see Eugene is chomping at the bit. Let me ask that everybody step up to the microphone, or in Eugene's case, if you're close, we can pass one around, but we're recording the session. So go ahead and ask questions now.
I've been working in the interoperable in the interoperability area almost since I started in the health IT space, and it seems that everyone wants it, but what as in the example with Lincoln, what is the incentive for big companies who control, you know, large double digits of the market to make their system interoperable with someone? They currently have vendor lock-in. It's working very, very effectively for them. There doesn't seem to be a business case for them, at least at the moment, in making their systems interoperable. We have proprietary suffixes. We have even standards that are meant to be interoperable. Let's pick on 11073. Has this nice capability of set a flag of proprietary namespace, and then you can send anything you want, and it's no longer interoperable. But it's a subset of an interoperable standard, so it must be interoperable, right? Except it's a proprietary part of that standard. So it seems that even every time you try to introduce something that's meant to be interoperable, there's always a lock-in loophole. This would have to be from a regulatory side. There doesn't seem to be a pathway to this from the directly from the manufacturers, and I wonder if you could comment.
It seems like for in every sector you've got this phenomena, which is the big players try to establish the standards for themselves. But I would put one defense in this area compared to, say, you know, screws or railroad guide, widths. This is a much harder thing to do standards in. So you think of like standardizing medical ontology. That's a deep problem by itself. It's not like just settling on a screw thread. So I would expect this to be challenging, and you know, made more so by vendors who want to get lock-in. But an example of a driver here is that when HIPAA came out, there was no standard to bill insurance on codes, and so that the ICD-9 codes that have been adopted. So when I looked at my CCDA, you know, I could look at it and it had standardized codes. Okay, I mean, you know, the ICD-9 codes were there, and so There has been some progress, and the HIPAA regulations have been a driver, although I'm sure we're going to have the same phenomena that you're talking about, is once you get a big incumbent, they want proprietary variations of everything.
Well, your question is really more of an economic and policy question than a technical question, so I'm not the right person to answer it, but I'll try anyway. And I think in the end it's going to be a combination of regulatory and market incentives. If the customers of the companies that produce the systems, not just the EHRs, but the other systems that have to interoperate, that includes lab systems and remote telemonitoring systems and so forth, if the customers who are buying those things, the hospitals or insurers, have a need, a business need, for that interoperability, then they will demand it. They will choose a vendor who can provide it to the extent that they have choice, right?
No one provides it.
I understand, but somebody will if it's a need that the market is demanding. Now, why would they demand it, right? There might be two reasons. One is it is better for them in a business sense to have that capability, and the other is might be regulations that are encouraging or enforcing providers to work together. And that might be driven by the payers, such as Medicare, or it might be driven by governmental regulations that say thou shalt, you know, interoperate, interchange records. Patients have the right to move their records from one provider to another. You have to do this or we won't pay you, you know, as a simplification of a regulation. And so if the providers, the health providers, need this capability, the market will demand it of the vendors. And so to me, in my very simple-minded and non-expert way, I think that's probably where it's coming. And accountable care may be one of the techniques that drives that.
I think that's one thing that Dave's mentioning that I think is a very good point is that we have these massive programs, Medicare and Medicaid, that can drive vendor market. So that, that's a lever that doesn't exist in some other sectors. And so the amount of money involved in those two programs is so great that you can drive a standard just by that. I wanted to go back to this, just briefly to this point about the importance of actually, you know, how hard it is to do the standards in this space, though. So even, you know, we shouldn't be on the sidelines criticizing the failure to get the standards done only, but we should also be stepping up with our own ideas on how to do these things. So here's an example of some of the things in the security sector that need standardization in the field. So for example, there's security relevant ontology, such as the definition of a minor in computerized form that would allow you to exchange documents and treat minors in accordance with state rules about minors. Another one that's really hard is roles in hospitals. So you have a role like a doctor, but sometimes that doesn't seem like a very good role because doctors like do different things, like a cardiologist is very different from a urologist, and the roles might need to be specialties rather.
The difference between a resident and attending.
And then they have all the different kinds of physicians, and then there's the chaplain, and so on. So when you try to do access control for hospitals, those problems, you can't just solve it for one hospital. There'll have to be standards for multiple hospitals, otherwise it'll be impractical. Another example is labeling of sensitive data. So thinking of least privilege, one of the things that, you know, from the security perspective, you say that if someone has like mental health records and they're not needed for every particular kind of thing the patient's being treated for, can you handle them separately? And they haven't figured out how to do that yet. And so those are problems we can be working on to make a positive contribution.
And the policy issues aren't even solved.
Yeah, and so break the glass is like a, the sort of thing of, like, you tell the physician that if they want to access this, they have to override. And if it's not done well, every one of them will override, and you'll be back to, like, you know, nothing useful. So,
break glass.
Yeah.
I have more questions, but if anyone in the audience, go ahead, please step up to the microphone and maybe introduce yourself, too, so we know who you are.
Hi, I'm Marcel Simon from J&J, and I have a question for everyone on the panel and for Eugene, for that matter. I wonder, what's the point of trying to do role-based access control or any other control on end users in a world where everyone shares everybody else's password?
When I heard that description, I was struck by it is the case that some of the hospital systems still, most of the hospital systems still use passwords. But an example at Hopkins is that they have a system where you have a card, you tap a terminal, and it puts up your state there. In other words, they don't use passwords. Mm-hmm. And so, why does the health sector have to be a bunch of Luddites? I mean, going back to this thing,
well,
we can do advanced things in the healthcare sector too.
Right. Yeah, my observation. So, I had a niece who sort of got sick with cancer, and she spent quite a bit of time in hospitals over the course of a year. And, being a techie, I tend to kind of look into this. So I'd find machines left behind in the hallway while, the nurse is inside a room doing some work or something. And then, of course, the machine is fully logged in. So I don't need your password. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I think that's an issue that has been pointed out to me many times, the issue of log out, not mm-hmm. so much log in.
Right.
De-authenticating people is right. Often more challenging than authenticating, technically. And actually, it's a problem that we're working on in my group. Mm-hmm. How do you make it possible for the computer system to automatically log you out or lock the screen or whatever mm-hmm. when you walk away mm-hmm. reliably and know if someone else has stepped in and taken yeah. over?
Systems that I've looked into or have to do with, you've got your badge or whatever that you plug into the system, and mm-hmm. that's what constitutes authentication. So if you take it out, that's an automated de-authentication.
Right.
But, that's something you have to remember to do.
My experience has been that role-based access control works great in research papers, mm-hmm. but at Hopkins, there are 8,000 people that have the same level of access to everything in their systems.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's made its way yet into, at least not into our hospital, into I think a lot of other hospitals.
Well, let's clarify now that there's one problem with the authentication, which is especially tricky in hospitals, and another problem even less solved, which is the access control and role system.
Yes.
So both of these systems are challenged in the healthcare sector.
And for what it's worth, it seems to me that the value of audit logs, to the point Dr. Said before about hospitals wiping their own audit logs because they can. Well, audit logs have limited value. If everyone is sharing passwords and it's not clear who's doing what, then lots and lots of people have the same role and that kind of stuff. So,
well, and also remember that whole concept now of team-based medicine. When you have various forms of access control, but you need to share that information with the nurse and the physical therapist and the like,
right.
If half of the team can't see the record, it becomes just gaga.
Mm-hmm. So. Right.
Anyway, I guess we've made the problem larger. Sorry.
Any other questions? So I had a question about mobile. There was a mention that that's an area that maybe could still stand to use some research where we could have an impact. And I've seen a lot of research papers, and I've seen a lot of attempts to build systems, for example, that would keep credentials on a mobile device or would display data on a mobile device. At the same time, when I look at research in mobile security, I'm seeing that the mobile platform is much less secure than even our insecure desktops. So I'm wondering if the panel could comment about the potential for using mobile in healthcare, especially with respect to security when these devices are so insecure.
So there's a wonderfully innovative physician at my hospital at the University of Pennsylvania who's developed a cell phone-based security system, handoff system that creates a sort of mini EHR that they love. And what she's done is basically hacked into the various systems and put it all together, and she's made a functional EHR that's better than the EHR we have. But in terms of security, they don't even think about that. It's not like we have lousy security. We have almost none. And sometimes the security is inadvertent, like the Wi-Fi doesn't work in half of the rooms or something like that.
One thing that's happened in this space, and I think that an interesting feature is that there's a chasm between the high end of the market, like defibrillators, and the low end of the market, like fitness devices, like Fitbit, and that the things on the Fitbit side have been generating an increased level of pressure for things that are big and inexpensive and highly integrated with you know, people's lifestyles and so on, and so you get a lot of things that are not very sensitive getting collected on the mobiles, and they give a kind of testing ground for the security. And so one can ask, you know, how secure. There was a paper at PET a couple of years ago on how you could just, well, basically you could just eviscerate the, you know, Fitbit security models. But on the other hand, people don't really care that much about those. But you could probably get to a point where these things could be a launch pad for better security once we get to, you know, actually taking that CCDA that I can download from my portal and putting it on my cell phone. You know, when we make enough progress on this other class of things that's driving everything now, maybe we'll be ready for that problem too.
Yeah, I want to distinguish in the context of mobile between smartphones and everything else, because I think some of your questions, Avi, were oriented around smartphones, and they are a general purpose computing device with increasingly various malware threats that could be a real challenge if you are storing medical records on the phone or using them to access medical records. And so I guess my thinking there is that there needs to be more focus on part of the vendors and the research community to secure those platforms, especially for sensitive applications like healthcare or e-commerce, et cetera. But beyond the phones, there's tremendous interest in wearables right now, especially in for fitness monitoring, management and monitoring of chronic diseases, telemonitoring of patients, and many of those are consumer-grade devices, and the companies who make them are focused on the function and time to market and not on security or privacy. It's just not on their radar. They kind of know they have to sort of be a little bit keen to privacy, but mostly they don't pay much attention to it. And so I think one thing that we can do as a community is to try to work with that vendor space to raise awareness of the importance of privacy, what are some of the threats of that data, and also to raise awareness of the importance of security. If that data is going to be eventually integrated with EHRs or other decision support systems, provenance is going to be important, integrity of the data is going to be important, authenticity of the person who you're tracking with the data is going to be important, and we need to solve those problems before they can be implemented.
Add to your list implantables.
Sure, yeah.
Well, that segues into my next question beautifully. So this will be my last question. Kevin Fu in the back and Yoshi Kono, who many of us know, had a great paper a while back on basically hacking an implantable defibrillator. And that got a lot of attention from vendors, and it got attention in Washington. And actually, I think when I started out the session by asking about impact and what can researchers do, one of the areas I think where we can do things is to do high-profile attacking of medical systems. At the same time, there's been a huge criticism of work like this because of the risks that patients who really need these devices won't use them because they've heard that these things can be hacked, and they'll end up being a bigger risk to the patient to not use it than that someone would actually hack them. And so the question is, I guess, as you know, we're the research community here, is it a good idea for us to do these high-profile hackings of medical devices? There's a lot of low-hanging fruit out there, and a lot of us could get a lot of papers by doing so, or is it better to just work quietly with the vendors and point out the problems that we're finding?
So I had an experience with this myself. When we got into I mentioned I worked in the power sector. When we first started working on this, my area was, the interest was electric power meters. It was obvious it could be hacked. I mean, you know, you could, like, the vendors would tell you they could be hacked because they had not put in the precautions. The real problem, and I think our community, Kevin, Yoshi, and so on, have been very responsible about this, is that you have to show how to do it well rather than just showing how to, you know, that it's been done badly. because showing that it's done, how to do it well, is much, much harder than showing that it's been done badly in some cases. And so I would not like to, it was an experience for me when, after I had been working on electric power meters for years, someone hacked one and this got national press. And, you know, it felt disappointing that, you know, it didn't get the publicity that they got. But it really wasn't the hard problem, you know, to hack the thing. And so, you know, making sure that we have, you know, a significant portion of what we're doing being making sure that the next generation of these things is less hackable and has better trade-offs, I think is important.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Carl is exactly right. Whereas it's stupid to not show that they can be hacked or even how easily they can be hacked, I think the responsible next step, exactly as you say, is to show how to make them stronger and less easily corrupted.
Okay. Well, I want to thank Dr. Coppell for his keynote and the panelists for participating in the panel. Let's thank them all.